This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
According to one climate scientist, we are at the extreme weather stage and rapidly heading into the red zone, and that is when, quote, all hell breaks loose. Who else says so? Your insurance company. Both Lloyd's of London and Zurich Insurance in Switzerland just warned of extreme weather events coming this year of 2015. The climate scientist is Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa. He has two master's degrees and is working on his PhD in climate science. Paul lives out the late Stephen Schneider's call for scientists to communicate. I follow Paul's tweets, Facebook page, and YouTube videos to see what's new and what's hot. Paul Beckwith, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Nice to talk to you.
Always good to talk with you, Paul. We get into some good things. So before we really get into the science, and we've got tons of things to talk about, the hottest year on record, the climate talks in Lima, Peru, you were there, still more alarming news out of the Arctic. But before we get to that, a little fact-checking. A couple of people seem to have misunderstandings about that possible 50 gigaton burst of methane suggested by Dr. Natalia Shakova from the University of Alaska and her Russian colleagues. Paul, what is she saying could happen, and has it happened yet?
No, I think most of the talk is about a paper that Peter Wadhams was involved in last summer. He got together with an economist, and they tried to assess the economic impact of such an event, whether it happened 50 gigaton increase, whether it happened over, you know, a year, over a decade or so. And they came with up with huge numbers, $60-70 trillion, something like that. So that's if such an event was to happen. Now, Shakova says that such an event could conceivably happen, but it's hard to assess the probability of such an event happening, say, within a year, or within 5 years, or 10 years, or 20 years. But we do know that as the Arctic Ocean is warming rapidly, with sea ice decline exponential, snow cover decline also exponential, that increases the warming up there greatly of both the ocean and atmosphere, and makes the probability of such an event much, much higher than it is now. I mean, we could argue about the exact number. We can argue about why that didn't happen during the, you know, previous warm periods and stuff like that. But it's certainly not happening at the moment. Methane emissions are going up quickly, but that event would be like an episodic event. It's not something that would, you know, you'd see a rise and a rise and a rise, and then it would happen. It would, you know, it's a very nonlinear event, an episodic event, and those events are very hard to pin down, predict in advance. You really, really can't do it.
Well, it's almost like an earthquake. I mean, we know that there's going to be an earthquake sometime here on the west coast of Canada, and it happens about every 250 years, maybe, but it could be 50 years from now or next year or 500 years from now.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. You're talking about the Cascadia Fault off the west coast, you know, and if that fault goes, I mean, the earthquake you're talking about is at over a 9 on the Richter scale. It would create a tsunami, which would hit Vancouver in about 20 minutes. It'd be about 20 minutes of lead time. So that's the event that you're talking about. Yeah, so there is a probability of this event happening. I think in the next 50 years, they've assessed it at about 25 or 30%. Could be wrong on that. There's a whole book out on it. But so that's the sort of number. What can we assess the number at with the methane burst? But the key thing is that the risk is equal to the probability of something happening times the impact of it happening. And this is a risk that people are notoriously bad at assessing. One of the things is you're multiplying a small number in general, which is the probability of occurrence at a given time, by a very large number, which is the impact if it does happen. And you could argue that that would be the whole planet, right? So you're multiplying a small number by a large number, and depending on the accuracy of those numbers, there's a lot of uncertainty. And we don't assess things like that very well in terms of risk analysis.
Well, it's the black swan event, you know. You say there are no black swans, and then one shows up. Look, there's some new science that bears a little bit on what we're talking about. Subsea permafrost is melting in the Kara Sea, unexpectedly releasing methane in shallow seas. And this isn't the East Siberian Shelf that the other scientists have studied. How could these frozen balls of methane, the clathrates, exist in such shallow water in the Kara Sea?
Okay, well, what happens is Methane is generally considered stable in the clathrate form at about, I've heard different numbers. I've heard 200 meters water depth and also 300 meters water depth. So, you know, let's take the 200 number. I mean, 200 meters of water, every 10 meters is one atmosphere of pressure. So 200 meters of water would be 20 atmospheres of pressure from the water and one atmosphere from the air, 21 atmospheres. So that's the pressure. And at the temperatures down there, you know, it's very stable. That's in water. You know, if you're in sediments and the density of the sediments is about three times higher, say the depth of the Kara there is 50 meters or so. So you have 150 meters of water equivalent pressure, which would be about 50 meters of sediment. So you could conceivably, you know, 50 meters into the water, 50 meters into the sediments, you can have that pressure equivalent to the 200 meters of water, and you can have stability. So how do you get through 50 meters of sediment? Well, it's not a uniform slab, as the modelers say. And, you know, that would take, if you just look at heat transfer down through that distance, it can take a long time. Like, they talk about 100 years or so. But what happens is there's fractures, there's imperfections, there's faults. There's talics, which are areas of unfrozen sediment. So water percolates down there. You know, and if the water's hot, then it starts melting, and it finds a pathway through. You just have to find a pathway through where the water, warm water, can get down, and then it will melt the stuff, and it'll come up. You know, and as the bubbles come up through the sediments, they enlarge the hole, and then you can get quite large emissions of methane coming up. So this is what they're seeing. So this is no surprise to me, given that the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf did the same thing as measured by, you know, the Russian scientists, you know, on the research vessels out there. One year, the methane ebullitions or bubbles were covering an area of maybe 10 meters, you know, hundreds of these things. They go back a year or two later, and they were a kilometer and a half in diameter, some of the regions where the methane was bubbling up. And also another thing is, generally, you know, if it's 50 meters of water, the methane bubbling up from the seafloor, generally most of it will get into the atmosphere when the depth is only 50 meters. You know, it's when the depth is much greater, if it's bubbling up, that a lot of the bubbles will disappear. They won't reach the surface because the gas will be absorbed into the seawater. So we can measure the methane in the seawater and look at the saturation levels and stuff. And we're seeing methane, high levels of methane, both in the seawater and reaching the atmosphere, both off the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf, but now off the Kara, which is even shallower.
Okay, so people who want to follow up on this story can find a link in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info, or you can search for the paper titled Offshore Permafrost Decay and Massive Seabed Methane Escape in Water Depths Less Than 20 Meters at the South Kara Sea Shelf, and the lead author is Alexei Portnov. Well, now, speaking of scary, you linked to a press release from NASA about increased solar radiation in the Arctic. Tell us about that, Paul.
I guess one of the key recent things of a lot of interest is that the NASA, some of the satellites, they have this instrumentation called CERES, C-E-R-E-S, and it measures basically the albedo or reflectivity of the overall Arctic region. And in 79, 80, that number was about 52%. So the Arctic region reflected 52% of incoming solar radiation. That was the albedo overall. Now that number is down to 48%. That doesn't seem like a lot, but it's actually a very significant amount because it's over the entire Arctic region area. So the Arctic's darkening. The whole region is darkening. And because it's darkening, it absorbs more solar, shortwave solar radiation from the sun. So there's less reflected back into space. There's more absorbed. And this is happening, of course. We know that it's in the oceans. As the sea ice area decreases, it's the white surfaces are replaced by dark seawater, which absorbs more energy. It's also on terrestrial snow cover, especially in the spring, less snow on the ground, the dark ground absorbs more energy. And it's also, you know, Greenland is becoming a huge impact on this because, you know, we have times when the whole of surface of Greenland almost is melting. So there's melt pools that are forming on the surface, and these are dark. These are absorbing more energy. So then the water in the melt pools warms up, and it causes even more melting. And there's been a lot of noise. I think one of the guys, climatologist Eric Rigneau, has done some videos, three or four videos, and you can listen to him. He's talking about the melting of Greenland, and you can basically hear, you know, panic in his voice. I mean, he's starting, a lot more scientists are stepping up to the plate all the time, but we don't have that critical mass yet. But it's coming very soon.
This is Radio EcoShock with my guest, scientist Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa. And let's talk about global risks, which you just happened to be teaching recently. Is climate change climbing up the ladder of awareness in risk assessments?
Yes. I'm teaching a course. Actually, I just had the second lecture today. I speak to about 85 students for 3 hours, try to keep them busy. And it's, you know, Friday morning at 8:30. I promise no equations, but I had a few today. But I was talking about risk and, you know, the probability of occurrence times the impact and how, you know, we completely assess it wrong. For example, you know, why do people worry about terrorism, right? The odds in the U.S. of being killed by a terrorist are about 25 million to one against. The odds of being killed in the U.S. by a toddler are higher than by a terrorist. You know, toddlers, they go, they find a gun that's in the house and they go and shoot an adult or, you know, a sibling or something. And yet, Homeland Security, terrorism, this is all we read and hear about. I mean, now climate change, the impact is enormous. You know, our food supply prices, it's a global thing, not just the Northern Hemisphere, not just the Arctic. You know, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. It affects jet streams, weather patterns, extreme weather events in the Northern Hemisphere, also in the Southern Hemisphere. You know, the impact is very high, and the probability is increasing all the time that we will have an abrupt change. So, you know, I think it's going on myself. I mean, that's a hypothesis of my whole research. So there's just no comparison. I mean, we worry, you know, society worries about the wrong things. I mean, I remember, you know, at a Canadian military display a few years ago, and I walked around and I said, you know what? What do you guys do? I don't worry about what you guys are worrying about at all. I worry about climate change. Person kind of looked at me like I was from another planet.
Yeah. You know, I found it interesting that that Zurich insurance report that you sent me a link to it, they found four climate-related trends in the top five, and they said extreme weather is number two of likelihood. But then, Paul, they put, quote, biodiversity loss and ecosystem collapse at the bottom, number 10 out of 10 impacts. Ecosystem collapse, that sounds like an ultimate risk to me.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, they talk about two things. They mentioned they had a category, a column for likelihood and also a column for severity. And I have a sister-in-law who works for Partner Re, which is, you know, the reinsurance companies that insure the insurance companies. And she's got connections and stuff. I'm going to try to contact the people that are doing this Zurich thing and, you know, actually talk to people that are doing the study, talk to managers and stuff, and hopefully they can get it a bit more correct. I mean, they're getting there, but they're not there. They're still too conservative on the climate change thing.
I'm glad it made it on the list at all, really. Now, before we move on to abrupt climate change, that's a huge topic, I'd like to get your update from the Lima Climate Change Conference in December 2014. You were there in Peru. What is your takeaway?
Yeah, so the Lima Conference was very interesting. I was there for almost 2 weeks, and I was actually with a bunch of people to give press conferences. So I was involved in about five press conferences personally myself, and one of them on the Friday, December 6th. If you just Google Lima, Peru, Arctic Methane Emergency, December 6th, then you can find it. It's number two. There's one, two, and three, and then there's some on the economics, how we need to restructure our economic system to deal with climate change. So they're all there, and I'll send all the links to Alex so he can post them. The one I showed the class is the one where I spoke for about 20 minutes on the climate system. So I spoke about all of these impacts. There was lots of press there. It went on the IPCC site. We talked about how the IPCC, you know, the consensus view is missing. The key thing with the science is they don't have anything in the IPCC report unless it's been in a journal for 2 years. So if something's just published in a peer-reviewed journal, it's not acceptable to go in the IPCC report. It has to be in the literature for 2 years. It might have taken a year to publish and a year to do the research. So there's a four-year lag, and it's just too long. I was hopeful at the conference because just before the conference, China and India had their agreement on cutting emissions. So a lot of the conference was India, them trying to get India on board. And also, there's very interesting stuff going on with religious leaders like the Pope saying, you know, we absolutely have to deal with climate change. So I think we're approaching a tipping point in human behavior to get a carbon fee and dividend and to get people taking action. And I think, you know, I'm almost certain that the sea ice will have a blue ocean event within this decade, and you know, I can't see the people on the planet not responding to that, treating it as like a, you know, as a global emergency that it is, you know, Manhattan. I always give the example, U.S. military budget is $700 billion a year. Right. Let's recognize climate change is a huge problem. Let's take that money, get all the defense contractors to look at adaptation, mitigation, dealing with climate change, modeling, everything else. Apply all that money and all their resources to dealing with this problem and making progress and getting something done so that we have a plan moving forward to sustain ourselves on this planet.
Well, now, I have another Radio EcoShock guest, Dr. Jim White. He's the director of the Institute for Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado. And Dr. White says he gets asked about the Arctic methane all the time, but he thinks there's a consensus it isn't serious yet. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, the consensus that it isn't serious yet is completely wrong, in my opinion. It's based a lot on IPCC work, which is based on models, and the IPCC work and the models are basically assuming that methane does not come out in significant amounts this century. And if that is true, then those numbers of like, 3 to 6 degree rise by 2100 and, you know, their other modeling numbers, there may be validity to those. But methane is a wild card and you can't just ignore the risk. And this is what is still being done, but we're getting closer and closer to people taking it more serious. I mean, even Obama recently is passing, you know, fast-tracking some legislation to eliminate, or not eliminate, but to reduce significantly methane leaks from fracking and from natural gas wells and from oil extraction and stuff, to put regulations, because we have methane clouds over some of these regions in the U.S. It's a lot higher than people thought before, and it's all adding to the global methane levels, which have been rising since about 2007.
Now, as you said, you've been specializing in abrupt climate change, and I know we've talked about this on a previous show, but could you give us just a nutshell picture? Has abrupt climate change happened in the past?
Yes. So between 70 and 40,000 years ago, the so-called DO oscillations, Dansgaard-Oscher oscillations, the temperature as recorded in Greenland ice cores, increased 5 to 6 degrees within a decade or two, with a maximum increase of 16 degrees Celsius in a decade or two. So very, very, you know, large change as registered in these ice cores. Going back further to the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum about 55 million years ago, there was data which I discussed in various cases based on a paper that came out sort of mid-last year, I believe, which seemed to show that there was a varved sample, so layers, individual layers each year could be recorded, and it seemed to show an increase of temperature of 5 degrees Celsius in 13 years back then, from a warm period warmer than now to even warmer. But a paper has just come out recently showing that those varves that they thought were in the sediment record were maybe an artifact of the drilling methods. So that paper, I have to discount that paper. Like, it's in conflict now. We can't say that this happened. You know, we definitely need more drilling to confirm one way or the other, but I just wanted to mention it now because I have talked about it in the past, that's all. But the planet is capable of very large, rapid swings in temperature. And, you know, we've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere, and the CO2 and temperature and things, they're increasing at least an order of magnitude, at least 10, maybe 20 times faster than anything in the geological record.
But let's face it, Paul, the climate system is immensely complex. It's filled with surprises. This Arctic meltback was a big surprise for many scientists. And on the other hand, earlier predictions of global heating based solely on our emissions seem to have fallen short because we forgot the inertia of the ocean soaking up so much of that energy. So are there laws of physics at work here, or is it possible we may not repeat past instances of abrupt warming in any time period that's meaningful to us?
I think there's no question that we will have abrupt warming again on this planet. The only question is, what is the time scale? You know, is it going to be 10 years? Is it going to be 100 years? Is it going to be 1,000 years? Like, do we know? Like, the system does change quickly. It goes from one state to another state. I mean, it's not a linear thing. There's so many nonlinear feedbacks at play that the system is quite capable of switching and switching very quickly. Most systems are nonlinear. I mean, you know, bend a stick and, you know, then take the force off and the stick returns to where it was, the position, you know, as long as you're within elastic limits. Exceed those limits and then the stick snaps. And it's interesting because you'd think it would snap into two pieces, but it snaps into three and a piece always goes flying off. And physicists just did a paper in the last year to figure out why a piece flies off, right? It's kind of interesting. But, you know, so if you stay within limits, then the system is stable, you know, but exceed those limits. And, like, negative feedbacks generally only apply within a certain range. You know, have an excursion too big and you get a switch. And this is definitely what the climate system is like. In fact, most systems are.
It's a very hazardous problem because if we could experience just a little abrupt warming and then plateau for a while, maybe humanity would be forced to act. But on the other hand, if it just goes slowly and gradually warming, we might experience that boiling frog phenomenon where we go over the climate cliff bit by bit, decade by decade, without reacting. Do you worry about all this stuff?
Well, I do. I don't worry about anything now. I'm well past the worrying stage. I just try to figure out what's going on. I mean, it's like a big chess game, and I want to figure out, you know, what the outcome is going to be, you know, and I want to try to make it favorable for my side, for us, you know, versus the climate, right? So if we have the Blue Ocean event where, you know, there's less than 1 million square kilometers of sea ice before the end of this decade, then the energy to melt 1 kilogram of ice, if that is applied to that 1 kilogram of meltwater at 0 Celsius, it takes it to 80 Celsius, so the system will take off. So once we have that Blue Ocean event, you know, if we do nothing, we'll have it 1 year, you know, say 2018, and then within about 2 or 3 years, it'll last for about 3 months of the year, and then within a decade or two, it'll be year-round. So what can we do? This is where, you know, my work with AMEG, Arctic Methane Emergency Group, and comes in, and I think about carbon dioxide removal and solar radiation management techniques. I mean, we have to slash emissions. You know, I think we can cool the Arctic with a combination of things. One is generating marine clouds, low-level clouds over the ocean, where the warm ocean goes up into the Arctic to cool that water before it goes into the Arctic. Another region is like the anthropogenic Arctic volcano idea. You can Google that, where we put sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere, not very much, and we could just put it in jet fuel. A lot of aircraft cross the Arctic that would spread it there. And recently I came across a very interesting paper, which, you know, just in the last few days, and it's really intriguing. It talks about, we know that when an ozone hole develops, the stratosphere undergoes a lot of cooling, and then it cools the troposphere. So that's one of the reasons why Antarctica is so cold, because you have that ozone hole. So we had an ozone hole in the Arctic a few years ago, I think 2011, 2012, something like that, and we lost 40% of the ozone. Now, ozone is created by sun hitting oxygen. It breaks the oxygen molecule into two oxygen atoms, which are very reactive, and by all probability, they combine with another O2, creating the O3, the ozone. So that's generated. So, you know, the Montreal Protocol got rid of CFCs, which were in refrigerants, which were taking out the ozone layer, but there are similar chemicals, halocarbons, which are short-lived. So if they're in the atmosphere, they take out the ozone and then they're gone, and the ozone recovers. So this idea is you take some very short-lived halocarbons, say that you've got a Blue Ocean event, economic cost to infrastructure and cities and stuff, you know, is crazy, like in the trillions of dollars. You know, it's up an order of magnitude 10 or 20 times what it is now. And, you know, food prices go way up. We can't farm too well. Then what we could do is we could take these short-lived halocarbons, put them up in the Arctic, combined with these other two methods, the marine cloud brightening and the anthropogenic Arctic volcano, and we can reduce the ozone concentration over the Arctic. And that would cause significant large cooling of the Arctic, you know, giving us a short-term way to restore sea ice and snow cover while we slashed our emissions. So, you know, it's sort of counterintuitive. People will have lots of views on this, and I'm just starting to study that, you know, at the moment to see how much cooling you could get from that. But it's an interesting idea. So I'll stick my neck out and talk. You know, I stuck my neck out and talked about it, and now I can wait for the criticism.
Well, you know, it sounds like you have an emergency patient and you want to stop the bleeding to start with, and then you want to find out what's wrong with the person and see if you can help them out. And you're talking about the emergency methods, really.
Yeah, interventions.
But our recent guest, Dr. Thomas Goreau, says the longer-term real solution, the only hope that he sees is putting the carbon back in the soil to reduce the CO2 in the atmosphere. What do you think of that?
So carbon dioxide removal is important. We need to not just cut slash emissions, but lower the CO2 level in the atmosphere from 400 down to a safer level of 350. So, you know, more obviously reducing deforestation, having more vegetation which absorbs CO2 is important. Like, is that geoengineering? I mean, geoengineering, I hate the term because you can talk about all the, you need to talk about CDR, SRM. Planting a tree is geoengineering, right? I mean, we've been geoengineering inadvertently since we've been on the planet. Able to, you know, use our hands to use tools and change things, cut down forests, plant crops. That's geoengineering. You're changing albedo. You know, we think it's farming, but it's also geoengineering. So don't use that term. So there are some very good methods, like organic matter on the surface decomposes, producing greenhouse gases. CO2 if there's oxygen around, or methane if there's an absence of oxygen, like in a marsh or something under the water. So what we can do is if we take that organic matter and heat it up in the absence of oxygen, pyrolyze it, then we create charcoal. And if we then put that charcoal in the soils, bury it under the soils, then it does a couple things. A, it increases the soil fertility, increasing the yield of the crops. You know, more importantly for our discussion is it's stable. This biochar, so-called biochar, is stable. It takes a long time to break down. It doesn't decompose easily. It doesn't decompose at all. It stays in the form and mixes with the soil. It's more like a rock in a way. This can store vast amounts of CO2. You know, another idea, you know, there's all kinds of ideas. Like bamboo grows can grow a foot or two a day. If conditions are right, even almost a meter a day. So imagine if I'm against genetic GMO stuff for food, you know, because we just don't know. Precautionary principle says no, you know, it's wrong to do. But suppose we could GMO bamboo so that it could grow in Ontario or, you know, much higher latitudes than the equator, then if we can get plants that grow a foot or two or three a day, then they store vast amounts of CO2. So there's an endless supply of ideas. So what I'd like to see done is, you know, one year we suddenly wake up and say, hey, we're in trouble. You know, we could wipe ourselves off the face of the planet. So what we'll do is we'll take the $700 billion a year U.S. military budget and all the defense contractors and stuff, and we'll tell them, you know, you guys aren't building any missiles or any tanks or anything at all this year. You're not researching new weapons. You're going to research climate change. You're going to research how we can remove CO2 from the atmosphere. You're going to run the models, your supercomputer models, to see how things are changing. You're going to put all the resources and all that money into addressing climate change. I think we could come up with very good ideas and very good rapid things that we could do so that Guy McPherson and some of these NTHE, near-term human extinction people, you know, what they think will happen won't happen, right? I mean, what they think will happen may very well happen if we don't do a damn thing about it. But if we start realizing it's a big risk and a big threat, you know, which it is, you know, I'm saying we, collective we, the public, then, you know, we can get things like this done.
Well, it did happen in the United States. You know, World War II came along when the U.S. went into it. They went to the car companies. They said, you're not going to make another car. You're going to make all war materials. Well, we can go the other way around and see if we can do something about climate change. And as Dan Miller says, well, if we go extinct, you can only go extinct once.
Right, yes. But however hard we try, I don't think we're going to do in all life on the planet. So if we do ourselves in, then, you know, things will survive, and maybe the dolphins will win out and become the sentient beings the next time or something.
Could be. So, look, is there any other science or anything else, really, you would like to talk to us about as we wrap up here?
I just want to point out, I did talk quite a bit about methane in this article by Dar Jamil. It's called The Methane Monster Roars. He had quite a long interview with me and asked me quite a few of the details about what was going on. And so that's worth Googling and looking at. And the other thing is, you know, the idea that we didn't get large amounts of methane coming out in the past warming periods during the deglaciation and so on, and therefore we can't get it now, I think that article is completely invalid because in all those previous periods, it was way, way colder in the winters, and it was warmer in the summers, but the situation was quite different. So the ice and snow could build up a lot more in winters, And, you know, although it was warmer in summers, the seasons were pretty short. You know, the warmth period in the summer was short. So there's a lot of factors that are different right now from that period. So I don't feel comfortable with their argument at all. I mean, I just don't buy that argument. You know, I prefer to look at the observations of what is happening. You know, the on-the-ground measurements, the flask measurements of methane, the AIR satellite and the IASI satellite data on methane, and, you know, not pay attention too much to the models.
Okay. And the period you were talking about where there were warmer summers but colder winters, when was that? Was that last ice ages or something?
The previous, like the interglacials and glacial periods, happen typically every 100,000 years. So you've got the orbital cycle of the Earth. The Earth orbit changes from circular to elliptical roughly every 100,000 years. And then you've got the tilt of the Earth changing between about 22 degrees and 24.5 degrees over 40,000 years. And we're at 23.5 now in that cycle. And then you have precession of the orbital axes. So these are the Milankovitch cycles. So the previous periods that were warmer than now had much steeper tilt of the Earth. So when the tilt of the Earth is greater, the seasonality becomes more amplified. So the summers are much warmer and the winters are much colder, right? So that's quite a different situation than... And also at night, as soon as the sun dropped, the radiation out to space could be very high. Even the temperatures, the daily temperatures, they may have been warmer in the daytime, but they were much colder at night. Now we have a blanket of CO2 and of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that traps the heat, and that's 24/7, right? You know, the sun's up, the sun's down, we get the warming during the day. During the night, I mean, that the heat can't escape. We've got that blanket 24/7. So it's completely different in my view. This is more information. Rather than a single paper for this reference, I'd say it's more in, you know, anybody if looks up a paleo records book or something. I have some good references, which I'll let you know. Some good books. If people are interested, you know, I highly recommend that, you know, if they have the time to if they want to look at it more detail, to read some of them.
And I will put that in my blog at ecoshock.info. We've been talking with our regular guest, Paul Beckwith. He's a climate scientist from the University of Ottawa. You can follow him on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube.
They can find me on Twitter and at Paul H. Beckwith. On Facebook, just as Paul Beckwith, I'm sitting in front of books. I never change the little photograph. People can even email me, phbeckwith@rogers.com. My email sometimes is worse than snail mail, depending on how many emails I get. But, you know, my iPhone's always on, basically, on the web. So it's much quicker to message me on Facebook or send me a Twitter message or something. So, and also, I do have a YouTube channel. You can just follow me on the YouTube channel. And I do lots of videos and stuff like that as well. So it's pretty easy to get a hold of me.
And they're great videos. Thank you so much, Paul. It's always a treat to talk with you.
Yes, thank you very much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. We all fear there's something terribly wrong at sea. You can call it extinction or call it something else, but stories of dwindling ocean life are daily washing ashore. A new paper published in the journal Science says we are at a crossroads for marine life. The lead author is Dr. Douglas J. McCauley, head of the McCauley Lab at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Dr. McCauley, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Alex, thanks for having me. I'm excited to speak with you today.
Well, yes, let's start with this. Your new paper shies away from our land-based experience of extinction into a term few people have heard, and that's defaunation. Why and what does that mean?
Well, defaunation is sort of the faunal analog or kind of the parallel for animals of notions like deforestation, which are really familiar by pretty much everyone. The notion that we're knocking down forests, losing plant life at an increasingly rapid rate, and there's a way to study that. There are a set of drivers that create deforestation. Well, we're taking those ideas and applying them to the science of animal loss, defaunation. So here, our main interest is trying to understand how are animals being lost, what rates are being lost, which are the animals that are most at risk, and what can we do about that?
And you talk about local extinction, and then you use a very compelling comparison to a reduction in garbage workers. What's the story there?
Well, right. So everyone is very familiar with the idea of extinction, that a species is completely lost from our planet. The last one goes, and that's it for the species. That's a complete species extinction. Well, there's a handful of other kinds of extinctions, and I'm an ecologist, which means I'm generally interested in the role that species play in ecosystems. One other kind of extinction that's very important to ecologists and ought to be really important to anyone that cares about ecosystems is a local extinction or an ecological extinction. And that means that a species still has some members, some representatives out there somewhere, but it's been driven to such low numbers, it's now so rare that it just doesn't do what it used to do. And the analogy, as you mentioned, that I sometimes draw is, you know, if you think about the services or the functions of garbage collectors, it's critically important to kind of keep things moving in our neighborhoods and our cities. Well, imagine if they became so rare that on the planet there was just, let's say, 50 of them spread across all of our continents. Well, they wouldn't be extinct, right? But they would be so rare that they just simply don't do across to, you know, most of the areas that cities and where we are. They're not doing what they used to do. So our cities pile up with trash and that function has gone extinct, right? So that's kind of the idea here is that, you know, what we're doing and we concentrate in this new report on the oceans is that we're creating a lot of these ecological or local extinctions where the marine animals in question are still out there on the planet, but they become so rare that they're no longer doing the functions in ecosystems. They're no longer providing the services that they once did. So in all sort of in ecological light, they're effectively already dead.
So when we look at marine animals in general, do we know how much we've lost or how fast?
You know, we're still trying to understand how many species there are on land, right? And you can imagine how much harder, how much worse this problem is, understanding both how many species there are under the oceans and then what we're doing to those species. So, you know, everyone says that we're, and rightfully, that we're grappling to get a handle on how many beetles, for example, there are in a tropical rainforest. Well, as we sort of struggle to figure out how many there are and what's happening to beetles in a rainforest, imagine if you took that same rainforest and you put it 100 feet underwater or even 1,000 feet underwater. The job for a scientist to try to both see first what's down there and then what its populations are doing and how we're changing the dynamics of these populations is so much harder.
Another study about mass die-offs just came out in mid-January, led by scientists at the University of California, Berkeley, and published in the Proceedings of the National Academy. And they found increasing mass die-offs in the past 75 years, and they listed fish and marine invertebrates as among the hardest hit. Do you think, Doug, that this is part of the sixth great extinction?
Well, so much of the science that has been focusing on this sixth great extinction, as folks call it, and I think that's a great name that, and an accurate term. So what it generally encompasses is this idea that extinction rates are ramping up so quickly on land, and this is where most of these dialogues, the majority of these dialogues about the sixth mass extinction are focused. It's on what's happening in terrestrial ecosystems. So the idea is that these extinction rates are spiking in such a way that we're actually doing to the planet now the same thing that meteors and gigantic volcanic fields once did during our historic mass extinctions, that we're beginning a human-driven mass extinction. So because so much of this interest in the science has been focused on land, we focus on what's happening in the oceans. And actually, what we see in 2015, at least, in the past several hundred years, at least, in the oceans, is that extinction rates are much slower in the oceans than they've been on land. So we don't yet see the signature of a sixth mass extinction mobilizing in the oceans. That's the good news. The bad news is, just as we're looking to kind of get a sense of what's happening with extinction in the oceans, we see a lot of signals, a lot of signs that say, well, we're really changing the way that we use the oceans. We're really changing the way that we affect animal life in the seas. And we may actually, in all science, suggest that we're headed towards a transition where in the next few decades, in the next century, if we keep on this sort of business-as-usual path, we will see a mass extinction event in the oceans on parallel to what we see now on land.
Well, this is something I found really interesting in your paper and with the illustration that came with it. I mean, when I think of threats to sea life, I picture ocean acidification, overfishing, and pollution, and we'll get to those things. But first, you introduced a whole new concept, I think. You compare developments at sea to the Industrial Revolution on land. Can you tell us why?
Great. Yeah, that's a central part of this research. So just as I was saying, we sort of reviewed both what's happening to animal life and what's causing these changes to take place. And what are the drivers that are causing shifts in the health of animal life in the oceans? And the major driver up to now seems to have been direct hunting, direct fishing of ocean life. And what we're seeing in this research, which is a comprehensive review of all the different ways that we're influencing the oceans and life in them, is that we're on the threshold of a shift from hunting the animals themselves to actually degrading the homes or habitats that faunal life in the oceans use. So this does have, as you pointed out, some interesting parallels to what happened on land. We basically saw a similar kind of transition happen on land, and this happened several hundred years ago during the terrestrial industrial revolution. What we actually saw take form in terrestrial systems was similar in as much as we were once very focused on heavily hunting, directly hunting terrestrial life. So, you know, the passenger pigeon, that's an iconic extinction that was driven by people hunting them as a meat source, right? Well, when the terrestrial industrialization sort of ramped up and took form, we began eating up not the animals, or not just the animals, but also their habitats. So we use resources from the habitats to fuel factories. We put factories right on top of these habitats. Our civilization, you know, cities expanding, basically ran into a lot of the wild space that was once out on land. And when this all happened during the terrestrial industrial revolution, we saw a major spike in extinction rates. So it seems to be a pretty transformative period in terms of the way that we affect animal life on land. And so we, in this review of the way that we're influencing the oceans, see a major new shift in the way that we use the oceans, and it looks like this shift involves or centers around an industrialization, or emerging industrialization of human use in the oceans. So we're building power plants in the oceans. We're now building factory farms in the oceans. We have feeding lots for tuna in the seas. We're handing out claims for mining even the deepest parts of the ocean. So a lot of this new industrialization in the oceans may actually represent an equally important and equally scary transition from hunting animals to damaging habitats, and that is what we predict may be involved in a very important way in a change in the rates of marine animal extinction.
Oh boy, underwater mines, floating cities, underwater power plants.
Radio EcoShock. If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
I'm Alex Smith with marine expert Douglas J. McCauley. We're talking about disappearing sea life. Now, I've seen a lot of articles about warming seas, not just in the Arctic, but in many parts of the world, including off New England. What role does that play, and how will it turn out if Earth gets hotter and hotter?
Right. It makes the job of looking after, for managing, being good stewards for ocean life a whole lot more difficult. So for better or worse, the same day that our report came out highlighting this important transition period and the way they were influencing marine life in the oceans, there was another report that came out with NOAA, which basically stated that 2014 was our hottest year on record, and that's in the oceans. That's the increase in temperature in the oceans as well as on land, of course. And that heating up of the oceans is actually also going hand in hand with increased acidification in the oceans. So climate change, as it takes form around us, is both causing temperature in the oceans to go up and acidifying these oceans. And if you sort of think of, well, the oceans are one really big fish tank, right? Well, if you cranked up the temperature gauge on your fish tank and dropped acid into the water, that would be awfully hard on your fish in the tank. And it's essentially the same thing in the oceans, that all of the things that we talk about to try to ward off this slowdown, stop this mass extinction that may be coming down the pipeline, all of that is going to become a lot more challenging in an ocean that's hotter and more acidic. All of that's going to be much, much more challenging as climate change advances.
And then one rainy day in Vancouver, I was at a lecture with Dr. Daniel Pauly at the University of British Columbia, and he showed some satellite photos of trawlers scraping the bottom of the South China Sea. There were just arms of them all connected to scraping up and brown dirt behind them coming up from the ocean floor. We've seen the Baltic being scraped down. It's hard to see how anything will survive if we just flatten the whole bottom of the sea. Is there any hope for more sanity when it comes to trawling?
Well, we definitely need more sanity when it comes to trawling. It's a terrible sign when as those images that Dr. Pauly shared, it's a terrible sign when you actually can see the impact that you're having on the oceans from space. And with trawling, you can. You can track these vessels by this sort of wave, the plumes of ocean seafloor that's being dragged up, resuspended, and then let out as a wave behind these ships. Our global trawling fleets are growing in number. The amount of seafloor that they're covering is increasing every year. The depths that they're actually able to trawl is also increasing. It used to be that we just trawled our coastal shelves. Now we actually have technology that's allowing us to get down and trawl the deepest part of the oceans. And just as you pointed out, there are direct effects on the animals that, of course, being caught in the trawls, both intentionally and unintentionally, and really important and potentially more impactful effects, physical effects on the habitat of these animals. So it really does seem to, just as you can imagine, if you dragged a really heavy net or really heavy roller back and forth across the bottom of a forest or a seafloor for that matter, it's going to flatten things out. It's going to reduce the complexity. It's going to make these habitats flatter, more like fields that have been plowed under than almost any other natural habitat.
And then we have another study released last November, this time led by scientists from the Smithsonian Institute. They warn about dead zones that are increasing and will expand as the climate warms. Are these dead zones still relatively tiny, or is this a significant trend in the big picture of threats to ocean life?
Well, unfortunately, they're no longer tiny. There are hundreds of dead zones in the oceans now. We track in this paper, you know, as we try to describe this transition from impacting just species to impacting habitats, we track a bunch of change, including, as you said, how much trawling is going on in the oceans, and we also directly track good science, good reporting on the increase in the frequency of dead zones, the amount of area that's covered by dead zone in the ocean, and that's just skyrocketing. The graph we show in our paper in Science is aligned with a very scary slope. So what happens is, as we put more and more fertilizer onto our agricultural fields, that runs off into the ocean through rivers. When that all of that fertilizer hits the ocean, it causes these big plumes of algal growth. Nothing can keep up with that amount of fertilized algal growth, and then they eat up all the oxygen, creating these oxygen-free dead zones. All of the other animal life that, of course, depend on oxygen in the ocean, just as we depend on oxygen life on land, blinks out, and so we get these dead zones around the river mouths or any of these outflows with these nutrient-rich, nutrient-laden waters. And yes, unfortunately, dead zones are only increasing in the oceans, and something that just absolutely needs to be addressed.
So many more things we could talk about: the disappearing mangrove swamps, the huge masses of plastic particles in the sea, maybe radiation coming out of Fukushima. But I think that your paper here is about more than just cataloging things. You're trying to look at the big picture, aren't you?
No, absolutely. I mean, two things. And one is trying to get all these pieces of information from mangrove change to plastic increase to power plant production and in the oceans, and get it all sort of on the same page and look for the trends. And as we say, when we actually went through this exercise, the trend that emerges is this picture that we are indeed beginning to industrialize our use of the oceans. And then, you know, the neat thing is that because we've run this course once before on land, we can see what this industrialization on land did to terrestrial fauna and make some predictions about what it may do to marine fauna, which is the very subject of this paper. More importantly, we can actually learn from our mistakes on land to try to avoid remaking the same really unhappy future that we made for terrestrial wildlife for marine wildlife.
So timing is everything. How would you compare the timeline of human-driven extinction on land that we've been talking about to the current stage of ocean life?
Where we are is we're hundreds of years behind the curve in terms of our impacts on ocean wildlife relative to our impacts on terrestrial wildlife. So we've been impacting terrestrial wildlife for the entirety of our species, tens of thousands of years. We have extinctions that reach back for 100,000 years. Now, we also have been fishing in the oceans for an awfully long time. Some people argue that the capacity to hunt marine wildlife is actually a criteria for being a fully modern human. So we've been interacting with marine species, hunting them for a long time. However, the impacts that we've had on marine wildlife are yet much newer. The process of industrialization of the oceans, industrial fishing only began the last 50 or 100 years. Industrialization of habitat use seems to be just beginning around us. So we're hundreds of years behind this defaunation curve in the oceans. And that gives us opportunity, again, to sort of look back in time at what these different changes, these different drivers of and shifts in drivers for impacts on wildlife on land can tell us about how to negotiate a better future for the oceans.
I suppose there's another very desperate reason to hope not mentioned in your paper, and that could be that large-scale industrialization of the ocean may not happen. Maybe we'll run out of fossil fuels or we'll have some economic or climatic collapse. Does your work presume the human enterprise will continue on its current course?
Well, what we hope is that the really interesting and hopeful thing about the paper is that, and about the situation with defaunation in the oceans, is that we're catching this problem early. So we really should have been on climate change 100 years ago. We really needed to be thinking about these issues on land 300 years ago if we really were going to make a difference. Extinction and change in wildlife communities is something that builds up momentum, and it can easily build up such momentum. You can have so many extinctions in communities that it's hard to ever remake or restore communities to what they once were. What we point out in the paper is that we're just beginning to have, in the case of extinction, we're just beginning to have important, noticeable effects in the oceans. You know, so sort of line up some numbers here. In the past 500 years, we've seen 500 animal extinctions on land. In the same period, 500 years, we've seen 15 animal extinctions in the oceans. And so because this extinction as a kind of defaunation is just beginning to start, we can nip this problem in the oceans in the bud if we want to.
So what now? Doug McCauley, what do you see in your own research and career? And then what is the best pathway for humans as an international community?
Well, I think the nice thing in terms of pathways forward for ways to do that, to nip this issue of averting a mass extinction before it really begins in the oceans, that there's a handful of sort of simple and then slightly more complex things that each of us can do. So point out a few. So the first thing is that it seems clear that we need more parks for wildlife in the oceans. So everyone sort of has a sense that parks and protected areas on land are great for wildlife and helpful for wildlife. You have national parks that are chock full of things like bear and deer, and that's where they thrive. It's the same situation in the oceans. You put in a park in the ocean, and it fills up with life, and life does well in these places. Well, we're well behind the curve on establishing protected areas and parks in the seas. We need to play catch up. We just absolutely have to. It's also important to understand that, you know, we review a bunch of things in the paper. One is how much space do wildlife in the oceans need relative to wildlife on land. It's clear that wildlife in the oceans need more room, so these parks have to be larger. And in case we feel like, well, you know, it's beyond my power to set up a marine protected area, well, in many cases, it is the voice of communities, the voice of individuals that actually make these things happen or don't happen, that make these things big or small. So, for example, down here in the U.S., we had President Obama set up a marine protected area in 2014 that was one of the largest marine protected areas in the world. This happened in the was put out in the Pacific. However, the final size of this protected area was only half the size of what was first floated by the Obama administration. And that was, he cut it down in size simply because there wasn't enough interest. There weren't enough voices saying, yes, we really need these parks in the ocean to protect wildlife. Another thing to do is for all of us, particularly our policymakers, to engage this explosion of new industrial growth intelligently. So we need energy, we need food, we need minerals from the oceans because all of our cities, all of our populations are growing so rapidly. And we need to reach out and take these things from the oceans. And the oceans are, you know, a bountiful source of all of those resources. But here's the difference. The terrestrial industrial revolution ran wild. We didn't manage it. We really just sort of said, let's get as much out of this as we possibly can. And it ran its own course. We can't let the marine industrial revolution go that wild. We can very carefully decide where we want to put this new industry in. We can carefully zone out areas for wildlife and put industry in areas that are less important to wildlife and make sure we put some of these parks in between this industrialization. We do this intelligently and carefully because it's just beginning. We have an opportunity really to do this in a way that's compatible with a healthy future for ocean animals. And I'd say the last thing, and it's a challenging thing, of course, is to think about climate change. As you pointed out, you know, all of this is a bit for naught unless we address the fact that the oceans are warming and the oceans are becoming more acidic. So everything from small to large that we can do, from picking up and selecting more fuel-efficient vehicles to changing light bulbs in our houses, you wouldn't think that that has an impact on oysters or tropical fish, but indeed it does. You know, is even these little things that we can do to reduce energy consumption, reduce carbon emissions, those add up into what can be quite large changes. And just the slowing of the advancement of climate change, just the slowing of the rate that we're turning up this temperature dial on the oceans will buy ocean animals time to adapt. And they have capacity to adapt. Many of them do. And they have capacity to be resilient. We just need to give them a little bit of time to make all of that happen. So I would say those three things are really important things that are going to be part of this pathway towards a better future in the oceans.
Let's give ocean life a chance. The paper is Marine Defaunation, Animal Loss in the Global Ocean. It was published in the journal Science on January 16, 2015. The lead author is our guest, Douglas J. McCauley from the University of California, Santa Barbara, and he has help from other excellent scientists from Stanford and Rutgers. To learn more and find links to key articles about this and videos and the science, go to my Radio EcoShock blog published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Doug McCauley, your work has been featured in major media around the world, so I do appreciate your taking the time to talk with Radio EcoShock.
Absolutely, Alex. It was a really, really fun conversation. I appreciate you giving the science some attention. Really nice talking to you today.
I'm Alex Smith. Find all our past Radio EcoShock programs free at the website, ecoshock.org. Find links to pretty well everything we've discussed in this show in my weekly blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you for caring about our world.